This is the Artistic Heart Podcast, a podcast with an artistic heart and soul, with Anna Mead and Jack Wallen. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Artistic Heart, the podcast with art and soul. I'm Jack Wallen, and I am here with my wonderful co-host,
Anna Mead.
And we are here to talk to you about the arts and how they affect us. And today we have something really special to talk about, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of slightly off topic, off the original topic, but you know that's okay because life happens.
Digression is, part of the joy of it, right?
Exactly. So we kind of announced it a few episodes ago, mm-hmm. but I am in the middle of directing the world premiere of my play, I Profundis. It was commissioned by Pandora Productions, which is one of my favorite local theaters in town. And it's a story about Oscar Wilde. And it's Oscar Wilde while he was in prison in Reading Jail. Mm-hmm. And how originally it was, the idea behind the play was about his love affair with Lord Alfred Douglas, mm-hmm. aka Bosie, and how that changed him while he was imprisoned. And as I wrote the play, it eventually became more about how being imprisoned affected his ability to be an artist.
Well, and people may not know, of course,
he was in prison
homosexuality. Which they called buggery.
Right.
So just really appalling. And he died early because of it.
Yeah. And the original topic was going to be based on a famous quote of Oscar Wilde that goes something like this: "Be yourself, everyone else is already taken," mm-hmm. which is a great quote. And especially it's a great quote for artists to consider because, you know, I'm a big proponent of being yourself.
There's only one you.
Right. And being unique. Mm-hmm. But here's something that happened. I have, over the past few weeks, as an artist, I have suffered from some pretty profound and serious imposter syndrome and I'm feeling like a failure at every possible corner. And last night or yesterday, something dawned on me. And this kind of speaks to the power of art. I realized that for the past few weeks, I have been dealing with a play wherein the one and only character is embroiled in a battle wherein he is looking at the possibility of his incarceration stripping him from his art, of mm-hmm. his art, and how that has, and the question being, will I ever be able to create again? And
it
I realized
like the answer for Wilde is no.
Right. And I realized yesterday that dealing with this play for so long has caused me to empathize so deeply with mm-hmm. Wilde's character that I started taking on his doubt. Mm-hmm. And the ironic thing is the play I Profundis is, at least from my perspective, one of the finest things I've ever written. It was one of the most challenging things I've ever written because mm-hmm. I had to make my words sound like Wilde's words, which is really hard to say the
Not
least.
Not an easy task.
No. But discovering that yesterday was, there were layers to it. One of the layers was that I felt somewhat relieved in that the struggle that I was going through was directly because of the art that I was creating, which there's a bit of irony in that, that I was worried that I would never be able to create art again while I was creating art.
Yeah. Nobody says imposter syndrome is sensible.
No, it's not. And the other level is that how art affects us and how sometimes we don't know how art affects us.
Until we're on the other side.
Until, exactly. And so I'm really on one. this is kind of complicated here. On one hand, I am so excited mm-hmm. for artists to be able to witness this production. Not only because I'm very proud of the words that I wrote, but also because the actor Michael Drury is doing he's absolutely killing it.
He's one of the greats in our city.
Yeah. And his portrayal of Oscar Wilde will be one that people will talk about for a very long time. But on the other hand, I also know that there will be artists who will watch this show and will take on that doubt. and they will start to question, because we've all been living what Wilde went through. Not necessarily imprisoned, but we have been imprisoned by this pandemic.
And
other artists have experienced this before, where you have had to take on a day job and you were afraid that your day job was going to strip you of your ability to create art simply because you don't have time.
Mm-hmm. Or energy or the
will to do it. And it's such a double-edged sword. But what I think should come out of this is the importance of our art to us, that it does define us. It does make us who we are. And it is a very important part of our lives that we should not ever let go of.
Yeah. Well, and we came up with this list of topics a long time before you knew that, like, this play would be occurring at this.
Right. Right.
It's just kind of a happy accident.
It was. And very, a lot of art happens like that in a sort of happy accident way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was like, this is the first time I didn't just write it, I'm also directing it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is the first time I've directed since the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a very eye-opening experience for me, because not only am I looking at this through a playwright's eyes, but I'm looking at it through a director's eyes, while at the same time sympathizing with an actor, because this is an author. It's a very challenging play, not only in that it's a one person show, so there's a ton of lines to memorize, but the lines are also complex,
mm-hmm.
and the journey that the actor goes through is not an easy one. So actors that watch this are, you know, on one hand, they're probably going to be envious of Michael. They're also going to be, they're going to watch this and go, oh my gosh, I don't know how he did this. but at the same time, it should make them excited to get back to work again.
Right.
And to know that this pandemic is not going to permanently strip us of our art.
Yeah, it's not the sum of who we are.
No. No. I mean, but the other thing is that doing this production has also reminded me, and this could just be from my perspective and for me alone, not alone, but I know there are other, because I know there are plenty of people out there like this, but putting on multiple artistic hats, I think, makes one a better artist.
Yeah.
For example, because I am primarily an actor, while I'm directing Michael, I can more easily communicate things to him.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can empathize for what he's having to struggle with because of so many lines and the difficulties of the journey and things like that. And as a playwright, I can also relate on all of those levels. And mm-hmm. and while I'm watching as a director, I can say, you know what, that beat doesn't work. We either need to fix it as director actor, or I need to fix it as a playwright. And we've done quite a lot of that. The original script probably would have wound up being 3 hours long, and I cut,
which would be a little much for a one man show.
Exactly, but
it's not War and Peace.
This realization that I had yesterday, it was powerful. And, you know, as artists, every artist I know has undergone and suffered imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
And eventually, I think you either just let it go, or you look at, stare it down and say, you have no power over me.
Or it eats you and you never create.
Yeah, exactly. And you never create again. And I know artists that has happened to, that they have just said, I can't do this anymore. Yeah. I can't take the doubt.
It's painful.
It is. And, but for me, it was a relief, because so often when I struggle with imposter syndrome, it takes me a while to finally back it down. But this time around, it was like, oh my gosh, I'm suffering from vicarious imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm. You know, and really, you don't need that, Jack. I mean, we have plenty of our own.
I know.
Oscar Wilde's imposter syndrome.
And because with Oscar Wilde, you know, you take on that, you take on an awful lot of other things.
Yeah.
And, you know, his life was, it's tragic.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
You know, he questioned whether or not he would ever write again after prison. And it turns out he never did.
Right.
And
was a loss.
Yeah, it was. But at the same time, he was also a victim of his own predilections.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, his lifestyle contributed to his downfall.
Well, true, but it shouldn't have been an outlawed lifestyle.
Well, of course
not. In the first place.
No, it's not at all. But unfortunately,
I mean, yeah, you could say, well, you know, don't be gay, but that doesn't really work.
Right. Well, it wasn't just about him being gay. It was his excessive drinking.
Shot off his mouth to the wrong people.
Exactly. It really was an instance of the whole of Oscar Wilde was just too much for society.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are people like that. And many artists feel like that. They feel like they're too much. They're too loud. They're too present, too big. And so they shrink themselves at cost, right?
Yeah, and the cost being what some of that which made you unique.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Now, I will say this, however. Back when I was in undergraduate school, this was a long time ago.
Many moons ago,
in a far off place, lived a handsome prince. I can't remember the rest of that lyric. That's from "Princess and the Pea." No, what's that musical called?
Once Upon a Mattress.
Once Upon a Mattress. Yes, that was one of the first musicals I ever did. Anyway, back when I was in undergraduate school, I was big, and I don't mean physically. I was big. Mm-hmm. I was a lot to handle. But I came from a
very...
I feel
like a lot of us were that.
We were. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that a great many of us, were big fish in small ponds in high school. Mm-hmm. And we made the leap to undergraduate school, but psychologically, we didn't go, whoa, wait a second. I'm now a medium fish in a medium pond. And the further we go with our education, then you jump to graduate school and all of a sudden I'm a small fish in a small pond or a small fish in a big pond. And your mind and your heart don't quite make that leap as quickly as you do. Mm-hmm. So when I went from high school to undergraduate school, I think if I went back in time, I would have said, you know, I don't like you so much.
I mean, probably most of us, if we time traveled back to our younger selves, that would be what we say.
Now, the difference between undergraduate and graduate school was drastic, because I went from being a big fish in a small pond, or big fish in a medium pond, to being a small fish in a big pond, where I felt like I was way behind my fellow students. And I had a lot to learn. So that was very humbling. And I'm glad that I had to experience that, because had I not experienced that humbling, me walking out of graduate school, I probably would not have had the career I had.
Right.
I would have walked into the first professional theater outside of grad school, and at the end of my contract, at the end of that contract, that theater would have said, "Nah, we don't want you back."
Right.
Or they would have, you know, sent past word around about me. You know, you don't want to deal with this guy. And, you know, that's kind of what happened with Oscar Wilde. And you know, as I'm dealing with this play, you know, I have a great amount of sympathy for him because, mm-hmm. because every artist knows what it's like, knows that fear of what is it possible that the thing that I'm doing right now is going to be my swan song?
Mm-hmm.
Or, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the stakes aren't usually so high as they are, well, like obviously in his scenario, but yeah, you have that feeling of like, is this it?
Yeah. Or it might not be, is this my swan song? Or is this the last thing I'll ever do? I remember to this day, every single moment of the last performance I did when I retired the first time. I was with Stage One and we were doing, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And it was a really, no, it wasn't Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It was, oh my gosh, I can't even remember the title of the play, but I played the fox. And I remember the last performance and how I felt, thinking I might never act again.
Mm-hmm.
And
fortunately, you did.
Yeah. I kept up a brave face, but inside I was, felt like I was dying.
Mm-hmm. It's an awful feeling.
And I wanted people to think, oh, I'm excited about the next phase of my life. But I knew that my life would never be the same.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and even though, you know, I did eventually develop a new talent, you know, for writing, and that has really saved me. That has been my life raft for a long time, but it's not the same. No. You know, and I remember last week or two weeks ago when Michael and I had our first rehearsal at the Henry Clay Building, the theater where the show is going to be filmed. The second I walked into that building, into that theater, I felt like I was alive again.
Hmm.
I felt like I was alive for the first time in over a year.
Yeah.
You know, unless you've actually been in it, and I believe this wholeheartedly, that the theater, inside the realm of the theater, there is rarefied air.
Yes, I would agree with that.
And what you're breathing, you are breathing the spirit and the soul of so many artists when you walk in those buildings.
Mm-hmm. Everybody who came before you.
Yeah, and right now we're working on this show. I'm not just breathing in the spirit and soul of those other actors, the past and present, but we're dealing with a brilliant writer,
mm-hmm.
who wrote absolutely stunning and profound words.
Mm-hmm.
And it is an experience that I wish every artist, no matter what you do, could go through. And it was, while at the same time it's been agony to have to suffer through what Oscar Wilde suffered through.
Right.
It has been it's been joyous. So it's been a very joyous agony for me.
So do you think in the larger context of, because when we originally conceived of the idea for this episode, you know, be yourself, everybody else is already taken. What could we say about the larger picture about, you know, insecurity, about imposter syndrome, about finding your own unique style in your art, right?
Well, here's something that I was recently told by a fellow author, that when I was dealing with some imposter syndrome in that realm, that other author said, the problem, here's the thing about being a writer and being and having to deal with imposter syndrome. Most often, that syndrome comes because of consumerism and capitalism and the fact right. that you're not selling books the way you... it's a system. And I had this other author tell me the other day, she said, you are better than most indie authors I've read,
mm-hmm.
even though your book sales may not always reflect it. And yeah. she said, there are indie authors out there that are absolutely killing it with sales and their books are terrible.
Right.
And the reason why that happens is they're really, really good at marketing and mm-hmm. they're really bad at writing.
Or they have the right relationships.
Mm-hmm. I am just really bad at marketing. Terrible at marketing.
Honestly, I've known a lot of indie authors here. I've encountered people who are much less comfortable with marketing. So I think you should be a little easier on yourself. Well,
here's one of the things that I've discovered. I tend my writing, at least in my mind, my writing is I create smart words. I create smart stories and smart characters and smart books, and I write in a way that's a little slightly elevated. And I transfer that over to my marketing, and I think that's where I fail. I think I need to dumb down my marketing. But here's my point. My point is that when you're suffering from imposter syndrome, one of the first things you need to do is find out why.
Right.
Are you suffering from imposter syndrome because of a review?
Mm-hmm.
Because of a lack of sales? Because your show isn't sold out?
Because your brain is lying to you?
Because you're bright. Or is it even such that you're not getting cast?
How dare you, Jack, come for me like that?
Well, I'm talking right now. I mean, we've been in a pandemic. No one's getting cast.
Well, and I said to a friend of mine the other day, I was like, well, I don't anticipate being cast for the first couple of years that theater goes on. It's because the competition for female roles was already bad before the pandemic.
Right.
And now people will be so desperate to get on stage. Like, people come out of the woodwork it will be a challenge. Yeah. But all you can be is yourself. I mean, again, with our theme, because you can try to be smaller, you can try to be less, you can try and predict what directors are looking for, what readers are looking for, and you just end up doing a huge disservice to your art.
Right. You know, and I know that I have gone down that rabbit hole many times
mm-hmm.
with writing when I start thinking, okay, maybe I need to approach this differently. Maybe I need to write what's popular or write mm-hmm. in a different style. Then all of a sudden it takes me about a day or two to go, whoa, no. You have spent the better part of 20 years developing your voice mm-hmm. as an author. You stick to that.
Right. Because, well, and by the time it's popular, it's too late for you to
exactly,
write something new,
exactly.
Right. The curve has moved on.
Yeah. But once you have discovered what it is that's causing you to suffer from imposter syndrome, then you have to get real with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to say, okay, let's take, for example, what I went through recently. So what was causing me to suffer, and this is apart from the iProfunda show, what was causing me to suffer imposter syndrome was all of a sudden me comparing my sales to another author.
Okay.
And me realizing, me thinking, why am I not up at that level of sales?
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a while to go, there are numerous reasons why I am not selling like that author. Some of them I can do something about. Some mm-hmm. of them I cannot do something about.
Right.
Some of them I don't want to do something about.
Right.
Because number one, I don't want to write like that author.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think my voice is something that the public needs, or at least a certain category of the public needs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I am, and then I'm not that person. I don't have their contacts.
Right.
You know, and then it eventually shifts to, and this is a really hard pill for writers to swallow, but each of us has to accept it. In many, 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 many occasions, it all boils down to the right person reading your book at the right time and telling the right person about it. Luck plays a big part in success when you're an author. And that, unfortunately, is a reality that we cannot escape.
Well, and I think it's fair to remember that we're Oscar Wilde alive right now. he could have still written all of his brilliant work and might not have ever become as popular, you know? Right. There were fewer authors. There were fewer really quippy, clever, witty writers at that time. And so, you know, part of his success is based in his era.
Yeah. Imagine this. This is something I think about a lot. If Mozart were reincarnated today, mm-hmm. today, so all of a sudden someone existed with Mozart's skill as a mm-hmm. composer, that person would not be nearly as famous as Mozart, because classical music is not in vogue.
It's not, and unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, prodigies are much more a dime a dozen than they were then.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, now granted, Mozart was on a different level than everybody, but, you know, it would be a tragedy. And the thing is I'm sure that there are Mozarts out there right now.
Yeah,
probably. That we'll never hear of. And it's sad. You know, that we live in a world where sometimes being an absolutely profoundly brilliant artist doesn't mean anything. Because you could be the absolute best at what you do and nobody will ever see it. And that's it's a shame.
Be a Van Gogh and not sell a painting.
Right. You know, and that's one thing that we all have to come to grips with as artists, is that it is time to reevaluate what it is that makes you a success.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at is success to you making a living as an artist? And at what level of living would be successful to you?
Right.
Because I have looked back on my W-2s that I received when I was making a living as an actor year round,
mm-hmm.
and they are laughable.
Well, but so few of us can make a living like that.
Right.
So it's all context, right?
Exactly. But at the time, even though I was making as little money as I was as an actor, I was in heaven.
Sure.
I was living the dream.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And, you know, so even though I look on it now and think, how did I survive? Of course, I was single and I was living on ramen and Pop-Tarts. But
it maybe was not sustainable forever.
No,
but
it wasn't.
For that time in your life, it was exactly right. You know?
And to me, that was success.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it did culminate in a show on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though it was, I was only fortunate enough to do one show on Broadway, I was mm-hmm. fortunate enough to do a show on Broadway.
I mean, most of us never get there. So, yeah.
So it's, you have to constantly reevaluate what it means to be successful. And I mean, constantly.
Well, we move the goalposts too, right?
Yeah.
You say, if I publish a book, I'll be happy.
Exactly.
And then you publish a book. You're like, oh, okay, cool. But like, I need a second book.
Yeah.
I need a series. I need a book deal.
I need
a movie deal.
I remember after publishing my first book, I don't remember. It's a long time ago. Very long time ago. I remember the first royalty check I got from it.
Mm-hmm.
It was tiny. But I was absolutely overcome with joy.
Mm-hmm.
You because I got paid.
Yeah.
Someone bought my book.
Mm-hmm.
Someone put enough trust in me to want to purchase my art. And
right.
and that at the time, that was a success. And I would love to be able to go back in time to experience that joy again. So
mm-hmm.
I can remind myself, you know what? People are still buying your books. You may
mm-hmm.
not be paying your mortgage with those book sales like you used to, but people are still buying your books.
Listen, almost nobody is paying their mortgage
book
sales, unless you're like Stephen King.
Right. Yeah, there are a few.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen King, and there are some names I won't name because they have a stigma attached to them.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I think you probably know who I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's sad that we've reached this point, but it's our reality. And, well, you know,
why is financial success and artistic success conflated? That should never be the case.
You're right.
And
you're,
like,
you're,
we want it to be. We want to do what we love. But the truth I've discovered is that the quickest way to start hating what you love is to do it for money.
Right, right. You know, and I know for a fact, because I've dealt with some of these people, there are bands out there that have been that tour worldwide and have mm-hmm. have publishing deals with all sorts of countries, and they still have day jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the idea, and I know that there are a lot of artists out there that hide that fact because mm-hmm. they feel like if the public believes that that's all they do, mm-hmm. that the public will then value what they do more. So I know lots of writers who make it seem like that their full-time job is writing when in fact it's not, because they're convinced that when readers see that they're full-time writers, they're going to think, oh wow, they must be something special, I need to buy their book. And you know, the truth of the matter is that every artist I know puts on a number of hats throughout the day.
You have to survive.
You have to put food on the table.
Pretending like you're in some kind of like unheated garret writing on a typewriter.
Yeah.
Like, what good does that do anybody? What kind of weird Puritanism do we suffer from that we think that artists can't be comfortable?
Well, it's the same. And I think that these things go hand in hand. It's the same kind of attitude wherein people think the only viable and meaningful route to publication is through the old guard, through the mm-hmm. through the big five or big six publishers.
I was gonna say, now it's like a big three,
big four, big
it's
three.
Ridiculous, yeah. keeps shrinking.
And the truth of the matter is that the advances are not there anymore.
Yeah.
And you know, I know more people that are making more money as independent authors than I do mm-hmm. authors that are making money through a traditional publisher.
Right.
So, you know, even that you have to reconsider. It's almost like it's the same thing. It's like actors who think the only true success is performing with a Lort B or a Lort A theater
mm-hmm.
or any theater associated with Actors Equity. Mm-hmm. And they think that performing with semi-professional or community theater is below them.
Some of the greatest performers I've ever met, I met through community theater.
Yeah. And it's a shame that we have attributed success and failure to those things. And it's like
snobbery.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly what it is.
It's elitism. It's this idea of like, you have to operate art at a certain level for it to count, with a capital C.
Yeah.
And that's just, it's not true.
No. And it's like, it's like opera singers turning their nose up at musical theater.
Right.
What? Rodgers and Hammerstein? What? Stephen Sondheim? You're turning your nose up at that because it's not Wagner or Mozart?
There's all kinds of different genius in this world.
Yeah. You know, and look at modern musical composers. We're mm-hmm. effectively, what they're doing is putting singer-songwriter music on stage and mm-hmm. calling it a day. And it's selling like crazy. Dear Evan Hansen.
Yeah.
Look at, I mean, just listen. You can take musical numbers from modern musicals and play them on the radio and people wouldn't know the difference.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
And it was a rare occasion that you could do that for, you know, I remember the first time I heard One Night in Bangkok, not knowing it was from Chess, you know, Murray Head singing. I'm thinking, this was back in the 80s, and I'm thinking, oh my God, this is awesome.
It's a cool song.
Yeah. And then next thing I know, I'm in college going, like, wait, that was from a musical? and the guys from ABBA wrote it?
Most people discover it like that, right? They're like, I had no idea.
Yeah. And you know, then all of a sudden, you know, there's all those other musicals on Broadway, like the Cher musical and the Alanis Morissette tribute musical, mm-hmm. you know,
which wherein, is really just her discography, but
exactly, you know, and I'm like, at some point, what we're going to have on Broadway are discography musicals in every theater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's good. It's going to, I'm just waiting for the Judas Priest discography musical. And, you know, it's
cool. Might be coming. I mean, they have the Green Day one.
They do.
American
they do.
Idiot.
And I think that that's, you know, I would not be surprised if that's the future of Broadway.
Well, and at least Broadway has a future, because I know for some of us, like last year when it went dark, which has never happened in our lifetime.
Yeah.
There was a moment of like, is Broadway going to survive this? Not is theater going to survive, because theater will survive an apocalypse, right? There will always be theater, whether you're doing it around a campfire or doing it on a stage. But will Broadway survive? Right. Will the Great White Way and the culture of having all these artists concentrate in one place?
Right. Now, I hope, I'm certain that Broadway is going to survive. But what I hope is that there are some changes that happen.
Well, I think there will be. I don't think there's going to be any choice, right?
And I would like to see Actors' Equity become more than just a governing body for New York actors.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, when you think about it, Actors' Equity is all about New York and then some of the other, you know, the medium markets and, you know, Chicago and L.A. and I can't even think of any other moderate-sized markets around. And then all of a sudden, you go into the smaller markets and Actors' Equity, we're just an afterthought.
Right.
You know, and then at that point, Actors' Equity, being a member of Actors' Equity, makes it harder for you to actually perform. It's like, why can't you give me some sort of dispensation so that I can, you know, when there are no shows, when I'm living in a city, when I can't perform, it's like you're telling me that if I want to remain a member of your organization in the hopes that I'll get cast in an Equity theater at some point in my career again, that I can't perform. Well, guess what? I quit.
Right.
I will. And that's what I did. That's eventually what I did. I dropped my Actors' Equity membership simply because it became impossible to make a living here in Louisville as an actor. So I thought, you know what?
There aren't enough equity companies.
No, there's not.
Companies who hire equity.
There's Actors Theater. They're in Stage One, does equity contracts. And I think that's about it. So we have 1.5 theaters that offer equity, and to make matters worse,
Derby does equity actors, but like, I mean, that's in Indiana, so you know, I mean,
so and then, I can't even think of its name right now. Actors Theater.
We're getting old, Jack.
I know. When Actors Theater doesn't hire a lot of local actors.
Nope.
So it's. It became impossible to make a living here as an actor. So I finally said, you know what? If I'm ever going to act again in this town, it's probably going to be not with an equity theater, and it's not doing me any good. So bye-bye.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's necessary, like you said, to survive as an actor here. Like,
oh, and get this. If I want my Actors' Equity membership back, I have to pay them
$1,500. $1,500? Sounds like...
I have to pay the original... And that's what you have to pay when you first... Well, when you first join, you have to pay that much.
I see.
So effectively, what I have to do is just rejoin.
It's like and, a tax. Right?
Yeah. And they don't make any compensation for you at all. And it's like, you know, why? Well, give me a reason why I should join your organization.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well,
if I were
the only game in town, that's the thing. Is like, you play their game by their rules, or you don't.
Right. But that kind of brings us back to what we were talking about. You know, I remember way back in high school that I thought the only route to being a successful actor was being a member of Actors' Equity.
I think a lot of people think that.
And because it's, exactly. But the truth of the matter is, you know, you're probably, unless you're either a very special actor in New York who just gets cast constantly, or you make that transition between theater and film and television, the chances of you making a living year round as an equity actor are very slim. You would probably make as much money doing paid non-professional theater as you would being a member of Actors' Equity, and you don't have to pay the dues. Now, back when I was a member of Actors' Equity, there was another incentive in that the insurance was amazing. I had no deductible, a very, very minimal copay, and I That's all. And because of where I was with stage one, it was 9 months on and 3 months off. Right. I always had that insurance. Well, now it's really hard to get the insurance through Actors Equity. So there's no incentive. So, you know, all of those people out there that think that Actors Equity is the demarcation between success and failure of being an actor, rethink that.
Yeah. Well, and we're all hard on ourselves. The thing is, it doesn't matter what your benchmark is, what your goalpost is, you're going to move it. You're going to think that you're not good enough.
Yeah.
And it's not true.
And I think that's ultimately that is a contract we sign up with ourselves. That when we become an artist, we know that we are always going to be the hardest on ourselves. It's like, you know what, reviewers, say what you want. You're not going to say anything worse than I've said to myself.
As I am to myself.
Exactly. And guess what? I do it all the time. Mm-hmm. I beat myself up every day. Mm-hmm. You get maybe one or two chances a year to beat me up.
This is amateur hour.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, but ultimately in the end, you need to decide what it is that's causing you to feel that imposter syndrome and then be realistic with it. And then say, if it's all about making a living at my art, then I have to compare myself to everybody else.
Right.
And remember that 98% of even members of Actors Equity Association, 98% of them are unemployed. So,
that's a depressing idea.
It really is. So, you know, take the successes when you can get them, relish them, and remember them. And know that there's going to be more successes.
You almost have to put them on like sticky notes and put them on your mirror and be like, hey, remember when I did this? Because after a while, when you've been an artist, you start to forget all the stuff you've accomplished because you sort of dismiss it. You're like, oh, well, yeah, I did that. But so what? Well,
I have a collage hanging in my bathroom that has pictures of some of the shows that I've done.
I think that's smart.
And they were kind of handpicked because they were shows that represent what I think is the best of what I've done so far. So every day I look at those pictures and I remind myself of my successes.
Like, hey, I did that.
And I always remind myself that there will be more of those.
Right.
So
because we're not Oscar Wilde.
No, we're not. We're not.
Thankfully.
Yeah. So, we'll wrap this up by saying that the world premiere of I Profundis is being filmed next week. It will be streamed. Mm-hmm. I wish there could be a live audience for this. So get your tickets for it. I think every artist should see this. Now, I don't know by the time this thing airs, by the time this episode airs, it's probably going to be long gone.
Yeah, so I guess so. We're launching soon, but
Yeah. So if you did see it, thank you.
Thanks for buying a ticket.
If you didn't see it, I know that Michael plans on keeping the show in his back pocket.
Yeah.
And I have given him the rights to do so.
Hmm.
So, you know, it'll come around again, hopefully for a live audience. And, you know, whenever you get the chance to work on or with something special, take it.
Yeah. Grab it and hold it with both hands.
Yes. And relish it.
Mm-hmm.
And let it change you. You know, be an agent of change, but at the same time, let those things change you as well. Because as an artist, you always have to be evolving. You have to evolve your craft. You have to evolve your mindset. Mm-hmm. And you have to evolve what you consider success.
I think we can stop there, huh?
I think so. Thank you for listening, everyone. You can find us both on Twitter, where you can send us messages. What's your Twitter handle, my dear?
Ruana3.
And I am J.L. Wallen. So reach out to us and let us know what you would like us to talk about.
We love your feedback.
Yes, we do. Have a wonderful day and be safe.
Bye.
The Artistic Heart Podcast is produced by Anna Mead and me, Jack Wallen. It's distributed by Louisville Public Media. Our theme song was written and performed by Craig Waits. To suggest a topic or ask questions, feel free to reach us on Twitter at either JLWallen or RUAnna3.